Hello, I'm Matt Matem, Deputy Editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie magazine. I'm still covering for Jane while she's on holiday, and once again, I'm joined by our reviews editor, Matthew Leyland.
Hello.
So it's the two Matts again. We often joke that we should just be referred to collectively as Matts Leyton, just to make things easier for like our colleagues and our publicity contacts, but we haven't actually hit the deep hole just yet.
It's like there's one brain between us. Like they're paying for your consideration. There's one brain between us.
So this week, there's quite an eclectic mix of new movies to watch. Obviously, the Barbenheimer phenomenon is still going strong in cinemas, but also out in multiplexes this week are blockbuster sequel Meg 2, The Trench, Kokomo City, which is a documentary about black transgender sex workers, Joyride, which is a raucous comedy about a group of four friends who travel to China when one of them is there on business. And there's also The Maggie Moores, which marks a reunion for Mad Men stars John Hamm and John Slattery. But before we get into that, what have you been watching this week, Matthew?
Well, we talked about it on the pod last week and I hadn't seen it, but now I have seen Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Mutant Mayhem. I caught up with that.
We were both there on Sundays with the next generation of Total Film critics, aka our children.
Yeah, schooling them properly.
Did you like it? Because obviously I raved a bit about it last week.
You did rave, yes. Yeah, I did. Yeah, I liked it a lot. Yeah, especially as it went on. Yeah, I found it more and more satisfying, especially the last act. Yeah, I thought it was a very decent up to date. And it had a lot of heart as well, which has kind of been missing, I think, from the Turtles franchise for a bit. And I absolutely loved Jackie Chan as Splinter. I really thought he was instantly the best Splinter ever. And I loved what they kind of gave him an arc as well. He got a lot more to do, it felt like, than in some of the other iterations. So I was very happy about that.
Yeah. I love the kind of early flashback kind of scene you get with him and the turtles. You see their sort of origin story down in the sewers, and I thought that whole bit just worked really well and really kind of captured a lot of what it is like parenting. Maybe it was because I was there with young Matem Jr. But yes, I very much enjoyed it on second viewing, actually. I must say, always slightly nerve-wracking when you review a film and then you kind of go to watch it again and think, what if I was lost in the madness the first time, especially as someone who's very nostalgic about Turtles. But I very much enjoyed it, stood by what I had kind of said / written beforehand. Have you seen anything else this week beyond the films we're going to be discussing?
I signed up recently to Crunchyroll, the anime service, so I've been watching quite a lot of stuff on there. A series called Ruby, which is spelled R-W-B-Y, but pronounced Ruby. I'm ploughing my way through that. And Ruby kind of recently broke out, and it's done a series of crossovers with DC, both in comics and movies. And that's how I got into it. But now I'm watching the core series and absolutely loving that. That's one of my favourite things at the moment.
I've actually seen one other film this week that we're not going to be discussing in detail. And it's May December, which is the new Todd Haynes film, and that it played at Cannes earlier this year. And I basically went to a showcase of Sky Cinema where they were kind of talking a bit about upcoming films that are going to be out this year, and they showed this as well. And it was one of those times where I went to see it, often like you get at a festival, where I didn't really know much about it, except I knew it was Todd Haynes and it starred Natalie Portman and Julianne Moore. And I won't say too much about it because we'll discuss, you know, we'll review it in a future episode when it comes out later this year, I think. But I really, really enjoyed it, and I really didn't have any idea what to expect. But it basically, the basic idea is that Natalie Portman plays this actress who is going to be starring in a film based on the life of Julianne Moore's character. And basically, without giving too much away, even though you discover this early in the film, but Julianne Moore's character was involved in a very, very scandalous kind of, you know, relationship with an extremely young sort of boy, basically. So I had no idea this was what the film was about. And then they kind of ended up staying together despite her going to jail for those kind of illegal activities. And then the film just kind of follows what happens when Natalie Portman sort of embeds herself in their home, and this weird blurring of the characters. And I love any kind of like behind the scenes sort of filmy stuff in films. I love films about films. It's very arch in the kind of classic Todd Haynes way. Both leads very, very good in the film. So it's definitely one to watch out for when it comes later this year, and we'll talk about it in more detail then. But I really enjoyed that.
Excellent. Yeah, I'm
So,
looking forward to that. What a
yeah,
cast.
both very good. Julianne Moore kind of doing what she does best when she's someone who's kind of cracking up below the surface and holding kind of a grinning facade over it all. But yes, yeah, very, very interesting. And it's one of those things, because I came to it with just so little knowledge, I'm looking forward to going in again with more of an idea of what to expect, you know, and seeing how it plays a second time. But it was a very, very interesting film.
Sounds a bit Mulholland Drive-y. Is it
I
sort of
mean,
in that ballpark?
kind of, yeah, kind of. And kind of, I've seen comparisons to Persona, which I sort of get as well, and even comparisons to Safe as well, the earlier Julianne Moore Todd Haynes collab, which I can also see. There is something, there's definitely something a bit Lynchian in the sort of the way it is, this kind of perfect, you know, like Americana sort of family setup with these really dark undertones and this really arch music that goes along with it as well, that gives it a sort of melodramatic kind of quality. But very interesting film, and if you like Todd Haynes's films, I think you'll dig this one as well.
Yeah, cool.
But yeah, so that's not out till later this year, so let's get on to this week's new releases. So first up, it's time to take a trip with these friends.
I should never come to China. People are always thinking I have this perfect life, but I don't belong anywhere.
If you do not know where you come from, how do you know who you are?
Let's find your birth mother.
Will you guys come with me?
Yes, bitch!
Ni hao, Lolo.
Look at me! Look at me!
Our passports are in my suitcase that got stolen.
You know who can bypass airport security? K-pop stars. Everyone remember their names?
Sassy.
Cutie.
Lisa.
Lisa, too.
I don't believe these girls are singers.
Girls, show them.
Show them what?
You're a fan of Cardi B, right?
Yeah. Is she here?
There's some whores in this house. There's some whores in this house.
There's some whores in this
house. There's some whores in this house.
This is Joyride, which is the directorial debut of Adele Lim, who co-wrote Crazy Rich Asians. And it's also produced by Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg, who've been getting everywhere this year, not least Turtles, which we discussed earlier.
Back again.
And so, Matthew, can you introduce us to Joyride?
Yeah, so it's not connected to the Olivia Colman film of the same name, or the road-based thriller with Paul Walker from 20 years ago. So not the most original title, but yeah, so this is about four friends, and kind of the main character is Audrey, played by Ashley Park. She's an adoptee. She's a Chinese child adopted by white American parents. She's forging ahead in her career, but in order to seal a business deal, the person she's dealing with is very keen, because he's very keen on family. He's keen for her to basically produce her birth mother, to kind of bring her along. But she's never met her birth mother. She doesn't know where she is. So that she kind of sets off on a journey to try and find her, along with her three friends. But this journey is swiftly derailed. They get into all sorts of shenanigans on a train. There's drug dealers. There's some sports stars they run into. It's kind of one of those where it's all about the journey. So it kind of goes all around the houses. These four friends getting into all sorts of larks and shenanigans. And along the way, their friendships are tested to the limit. It's been compared sort of to the Hangover in some ways. I can kind of see that, but it is sort of more of a kind of a road trip movie in that sort of classic sense, where nothing goes right and the destination is always kind of changing.
And did you actually like this film?
I did, yeah, I liked it a lot. Yeah, I mean, I was kind of hopeful, kind of going into it. It stars Stephanie Hsu, who's had a big breakout with Everything Everywhere All at Once. I wasn't really familiar with the other actors. Who got I mentioned Ashley Park. Then we got Sherry Kohler, who I guess is kind of the Zach Galifianakis of the group, in it, if you were kind of pigeonhole. And then Sabrina Wu, who has the brilliant name of Deadeye, which she's named for a particular quirk, which is one of the gags that keeps on giving, I thought. So I wasn't too familiar with them, but I thought they worked really well as an ensemble. I kind of really believed in their friendships, the bickering that they do, and the affection between them. But yeah, I thought it worked well as a comedy. I laughed quite a lot. It's incredibly rude. I mean, there's one montage in particular that really stands out. But he's kind of, it's done, he's a very sort of like sex positive movie, or done in a kind of, it sort of reminded me of Kevin Smith in a way, that kind of like constant naughtiness, but done in a very sort of good natured, almost childlike kind of way. So I found that very appealing. And I thought it had a real kind of emotional punch at the end, which I wasn't expecting. I mean, I came in just thinking it's going to be a really raucous road trip comedy, which it is, but then it does have these kind of emotional beats. I mean, I had some reservations, but overall I was pretty satisfied with it. I enjoyed it.
I'm glad you enjoyed it, because it's one of those films for me where I was absolutely bang up for it, because I love this type of thing. I love sort of...
Yeah.
Friendship comedies, basically. I love raucous comedies, so I was just absolutely bang up for it. And again, went in, I hadn't actually even seen the trailers when I saw this, but I couldn't sort of shake the feeling that it was just okay, really. It was one of those things where, and I guess comedy is so subjective, but just quite a lot of the jokes just didn't really land for me. I liked the group of friends, I liked kind of spending time with them, and I sort of smirked along during a lot of it, but for me, I just never truly loved it. I'm going to sound really grumpy by saying this, but it was also one of those films for me where they get into lots of different scrapes, as you've kind of hinted at. And I mean, you can see a lot of it in the trailers, but I won't go into too much for sort of ruining some of the fun if you haven't seen those. But there's no real stakes to any of the sort of problems they run into, and that there's the things happen and they get arrested and things like that, but then they just move straight on from them and don't seem to have any kind of fallback. And so in some ways, something about that just irritated me a bit. I wish there was a tiny bit more at stake, especially when they are kind of tourists touring China, and there's the political implications of that aren't really ever dug into, I didn't think.
No.
I agree with you that then there is this surprisingly actually effective swerve into emotional territory towards the end, which I wasn't expecting. And that did work, I thought. And I sort of, I liked it and sort of smiled all the way through. Stephanie Hsu was probably my favourite of the gang. I did find her very funny.
Yeah.
But I just wish I'd liked it slightly more. And for balance, I'll say I was speaking to a couple of people the other day who'd seen it as well and who really enjoyed it. So I think I'm probably in the minority, but yeah, it just didn't entirely land for me. It was perfectly, I didn't hate it or anything like that. It was a perfectly fine watch, but I just didn't kind of laugh or get quite as into it as I just sort of hoped I was going to. It actually didn't do very well in the box office at the US, which I was quite surprised by.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, that's quite disappointing, really, because they have marketed it. Well, it's been kind of everywhere, and they've kind of really pushed. Was it the poster says about it's Crazy Rich Asians meets Bridesmaids? So they've really kind of tried to sell it and boil it down into that kind of really tight, high concept pitch. And it's not quite like those films. You can sort of see where they're coming from. It's got the producers of Crazy Rich Asians, but it is much more of a road trip comedy than those. But yeah, it was a shame that it did underperform, especially after Everything Everywhere's great success. But then, I mean, who knows what's going to succeed at the box office these days? It's so unpredictable.
Yeah, it definitely has that Planes, Trains and Automobiles type quality, doesn't it? And it got pretty good reviews as well. I think it's 91% on Rotten Tomatoes. So, it sort of reviewed well, but it'd be interesting to see if it takes off any more in the UK now, because it's coming out quite a bit later than it did in the US. So it'd be interesting to see if it gets much of a look in this summer. But if you do like the sound of that, that is Joyride, and that is out in cinemas now.
Nice and short as well, isn't it? Isn't it like 90 odd minutes? It's 95 minutes, which is quite rare these days.
I mean,
especially in a big bloated summer.
Yeah. Right. And also out this week, and also with a very lean running time, is a documentary that's probably quite unlike anything you've seen before.
What we usually do as trainees, we be broken down, but we need to stand out. You gotta be the bitch with the biggest boobs, the biggest body.
There's some guys that they just want to fuck you.
Yeah.
They don't want to touch the dick. They don't want to see the dick. They don't want to be reminded that you were once born male.
A lot of us are a secret to many powerful people.
She's not aware of the fact that her black successful husband is upstairs in their beautiful condo down in Tribeca, laid up with a black trans woman.
In no way are they there to protect us.
So this is Kokomo City. Matthew, can you tell us what this documentary is about?
Yeah, it's quite a sort of stripped down, very much a kind of a talking heads documentary, where with notable interludes. But yeah, it focuses on basically four black transgender sex workers, and they speak direct to camera. There's no kind of voiceover narration or sort of or captions, really extensive captions. It's just these four sex workers often talking direct to camera about their experiences, about how they became sex workers, what the sort of the nature of their work is, what their kind of ambitions and dreams are. It's relatively short. I mean, it's 73 minutes, which I mean is kind of pretty much unheard of these days for a theatrical release, but it is kind of very densely packed. It's, you know, with this talking, it focuses entirely on the four sex workers talking the whole way through with they speak to some of their clients as well. They kind of do some to camera bits as well, and there's a few kind of reconstructions which yeah kind of rival Joyride for naughtiness. Yeah, it's an 18 rating, which is quite unusual, I think, for a documentary. I can't think of the last 18 rated documentary I saw, so that's quite unusual. And yeah, and it's directed, produced and edited by D. Smith. It got quite a lot of attention at Sundance earlier this year, and various other festivals. It's on people's radar, really, as kind of one of the documentaries of the year, I think, at the moment.
Yeah, I actually saw this via Sundance. I kind of did the remote covering of Sundance this year, where you can watch the films, you know, via this sort of streaming app thing. So it's been quite a while since I've seen it. That was back in January. But yeah, what I mainly remember about it is it does just have this sort of quite ridiculous energy, really, doesn't it, with the sort of stories to camera. And it starts with this really wild anecdote that just sort of goes all over the place and is cut in with like reconstructions as well. It was that almost, really, like it was just the sort of energy of it really felt unlike anything I'd seen before, just because they all speak so fast and they've got so much to say. You're sort of dragged along by it, really, aren't you, because it just barrels along at such speed and with the energy of these talkers. And it's got this really stark black and white photography as well, that
with a few splashes of color, a few like bit of text, you get suddenly like a bright green splash of text on the screen, or pink, or... But yeah, it's all monochrome.
Yeah, it's very, very striking to look at. Mm. And obviously covering people who don't really necessarily get to be at the forefront of, you know, telling these stories all that often. So it's kind of an interesting new perspective in that sense. And it's, given the subject matter, it's very non-judgmental.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
As far as documentaries go, it's a real, real ride in that sense, I thought.
Mm. Yeah, it's very sort of matter of fact. I mean, it doesn't kind of shy away from the grim details. I mean, that anecdote at the start is quite alarming, really, when it's kind of told in a sort of light way. Yeah, it's quite alarming, that some of the details of it, but the whole way it's presented is kind of matter of fact. These are these workers' lives. This is what they go through and how it can change day to day, how their lives can be so up and down. So yeah, it's very sort of revealing and eye-opening. Yeah, and they're all like fantastic talkers as well. I mean, they really open up for the camera. So there's obviously quite a lot of trust there between them and the director. She obviously had a good rapport with everyone that she met and spoke to. And presumably there was like a ton more footage. That's why I was slightly surprised. It's so short, really, because you can imagine they must have been filming quite a while, quite a lot. But yeah, it's nice to see a sort of nice lean edit as well. You know, it feels like it's exactly as long as it needs to be, really.
Yeah, because I was reading that D. Smith sort of searched Instagram and YouTube to sort of find subjects for this and get people who are sort of comfortable talking and being on camera and sort of telling their own stories. So yeah, it does feel just sort of remarkably open in that way, where they just get straight into it, just so sort of candid, nothing really hidden, nothing off limits. You're quite bombarded, aren't you, really, just throughout the whole thing.
I love the soundtrack as well. I thought the soundtrack was great. That really kind of adds to the energy, buoys it along. Because it starts off with Street Life, which is a great song to open a movie with, and very apt. So yeah, it's very kind of well put together package, you know, obviously not on the biggest budget. Yeah, it'd be very interesting to see where the director goes next, how she builds on that, having kind of gained attention with this.
Yeah, and D. Smith was a music producer apparently as well before becoming a documentary maker. That does really play into that soundtrack as well, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So that is, if I'm pronouncing it right, Kokomo City. which is out also in cinemas now. Okay, so we have a slightly more random one to throw in the mix now.
Push jumper fell. Shot in the back of the head, dragging yourself away. My God, that's awful.
Vehicle's registered to Maggie Moore.
You say Maggie Moore?
Two dead Maggie Moores 1 week apart. Yeah, that's weird.
Mr. Moore?
Can I help you?
I'm looking for Jay Moore.
He's not here. They're separated.
Oh.
Big fight. You need to leave.
Oh, I need to leave?
Yeah.
This is my house, Maggie!
She did yell the word filth. I caught that.
Well, Jay Moore's into something.
My wife is threatening to go to the cops. I would like you to scare her off the idea.
This is the Maggie Moores, which I know virtually nothing about. So, Matthew, can you fill me in, please?
Okay. So, yeah. So, the important thing, the title, it's Maggie Moore, but then it's bracket, open bracket, S, close bracket, which is slightly confusing and unwieldy. But it's directed by John Slattery. I think this is his second film as director. And one of the big things here is he's reunited with John Hamm. They starred in, I haven't seen it, but they were in Confess Fletch last year.
I really enjoyed Confess Fletch, I must say.
Yeah.
I saw it on a plane once. Yeah. It didn't really get a very big release over here, did it? But
no, it didn't, no. But yeah, I really want to see that. But yeah, John Slattery doesn't star in this, he directs it. You can see the influence of Fargo on this one. And essentially, the premise is it's about this sandwich shop owner who's very dodgy. He's played by Michael Scott. And he's selling all these really kind of rancid sandwiches in his sandwich shop and dealing with some very shady characters. And his wife is threatening to shop him to the cops. So he has her murdered. And then basically to stop him from coming under suspicion, he finds out that there's someone else with the same name, another Maggie Moore. So he hires someone to murder her as well so that it can look like a case of mistaken identity. So these things, you can see it's all kind of spiraling well out of control, you know, as it did for William H. Macy in Fargo. And then you've got John Hamm is the cop who's kind of assigned to the case, and he's partnered with Nick Mohammed. And you've also got Tina Fey in the mix. She's a neighbor of the dodgy sandwich maker, and she kind of strikes up a relationship with John Hamm. So yeah, it's all kind of very Coens. I mean, I'd say as a thriller, there's never kind of any sort of mystery to it. You know who's doing what and why. There's no kind of mystery as to who's doing the killings or what any of the motivations are. So it's quite sort of low key from that point of view. But I thought it worked really nicely as a kind of like a kind of comedy noir, got a nice kind of sort of shambling atmosphere, lived in atmosphere. The dynamic between John Hamm and Tina Fey is really nice as well. Like she's a divorcee. He's been through a few relationships as well. So it's kind of like a very sort of nice middle-aged romance. They're kind of sort of circling each other. They've really nice bands together. And that sort of nicely offsets the other kind of really scummy characters in it, because there's some real scumbags in this film, nasty people. So it's got that kind of nice balance. It's showing on Sky. It's going to be on Sky Cinema now, and it does feel quite nicely suited to the small screen. It feels like it could be a really nice sort of pilot for an ongoing TV series. I think it's kind of it's best approached with low expectations, but within that, it's very enjoyable. It's very, very nicely played. I think Slattery obviously has a kind of rapport with Hamm. And he has just a nice way with actors, kind of lets them do what they do. And, you know, everybody's in it. Everybody in it is, even like the smallest role kind of stands out for being sort of quirky or distinctive. So it's one of those type of films, you know, similar to the Coens, but not quite as kind of exaggerated or heightened. So yeah, I thought this was really quite decent.
I think I'll give this a go based on enjoying Confess Fletch. And also, yeah. I was a big fan of 30 Rock back in the day. So there's a sort of a reunion of Tina Fey and John Hamm from that. I really loved his guest spot on there.
Yeah.
So yeah, it sounds like I'll give that a go. So if you fancy giving that a go, that's The Maggie Moores with a brackets S at the end, which is available to watch on Now TV and Sky Cinema now. And finally, the big blockbuster of the week, the film we've been holding out for, which is why this episode is out slightly later than usual, it's this.
Jonas, we need your help. We're detecting increased aquatic activity 25,000 feet deep in the trench. It's an ancient ecosystem untouched by man. Whatever is down there is trying to make its way to the surface. This is a bad idea.
Just a little bit.
Jonas, we've got company.
That's the biggest Meg I've ever seen.
Biggest Meg anyone's ever seen.
That's the apex predator.
Everybody make it to the station!
You can make it! Hit fly!
That was Meg 2, The Trench, of course. Now, Matthew, you haven't seen this yet, have you?
I haven't. I've seen the first one, but not this one. I haven't had the pleasure yet.
Well, I've seen both, and I can barely remember the first one, if I'm honest. So, I remember there being a massive shark, and I almost came to this as a newbie, which I feel like, having basically done it myself, I feel like you can kind of do it with this film. And I'll try to give you the basic setup, but obviously there's not really much in the way of plot to it. And
what?
I was even getting somewhat confused by what was going on at times, but obviously it's that kind of film where you don't truly need to follow the plot. But of course we pick up again with Jason Statham, who plays Jonas Taylor, obviously the hero of the last film. Again, I remember him being in it. I don't remember a huge amount about his character and what he did, but someone calls him a green James Bond.
Right.
And so he's sort of like a Greenpeace type activist, but with the martial arts skills of Jason Statham. And we first find him, he's doing some sort of espionage work, kind of taking photos of this dodgy company, getting into fights. And then before long, he's kind of brought into this big, I don't even know what you call it, this big scientific research center where they've been raising a young Meg, a megalodon in captivity, and sort of training it up. And it's here he meets sort of, there's another of the main characters who's played by Wu Jing, who's a big Chinese star. So he's been training up this young Meg. Basically, it's not long before the Stath and his pals are sort of roped into going down in these submersibles to this place known as The Trench, hence the subtitle. Where there's some sort of dodgy mining activity going on. They go down to investigate. There's obviously all sorts of prehistoric creatures down there, and things go from there. Obviously there's kind of conspiracies discovered. There's plenty of expendable cast members with him that can be obviously eaten. And another thing that's sort of interesting about this film before you go into it, as you all know this, Matthew, obviously, but it's directed by Ben Wheatley, of all people, who obviously you may well know from things like Kill List, Sightseers, High Rise, Rebecca. He did the Rebecca adaptation for Netflix a couple of years ago. So a lot of what he's done is kind of gritty, twisted, indie British films. A lot of them are very weird, very dark. So he seems like an unusual choice in a lot of ways for an absolutely huge summer blockbuster like this. And if I had watched it, I would not come out saying, oh yes, that was a Ben Wheatley film.
Ben Wheatley production.
I can't say I felt like
it's obvious.
I can't say I felt his signature all over it.
Yeah.
But on the whole, I actually thought it was quite an enjoyable as a, if you take it very much in the B movie spirit, which I believe it's intended, but I thought it was enjoyable. I thought it did the trick. Like I say, you kind of can't take it too seriously. Statham's character, Jonas, he's like a sort of superhero cartoon character type person. He does some ridiculous feats. There were some lines of his that people were sort of laughing out loud at in the screening I was in. He's asked to do a couple of just ridiculous things that would make Ethan Hunt probably balk at like having to do them, but he just gets on and does it. And another thing I liked about it is I actually did think, like, from the, and again, I say this from memory, not remembering the first one that well at all, But I actually thought this one had that sense of knowing fun that I thought the first one, to from memory, I remember coming away thinking it didn't have that sense of fun that you want from a giant, silly shark film.
It didn't quite hit the mark, did it?
This was the vibe I'd had from the trailers, and then I felt it sort of delivered on that in the film. Is I felt like it was much more knowing. Another key supporting character is Cliff Curtis, who's kind of a colleague of Statham's. And he was fun. He had some funny lines. And
he's very reliable, isn't he? He's always good value in a blockbuster.
And there was someone else who I couldn't remember if he was in the first one or not, but Paige Kennedy, who plays a character called DJ. And he was also, he had some quite funny lines, I thought, as well. And he was just quite a fun presence. And again, they very much knew what film they were in. You know, they didn't take it too seriously. They got the tone. They were sort of, they understood the assignment, as people often say about this. And it's perhaps a bit overstuffed because there's sort of corporate conspiracies, there's dodgy CEOs, there's, you know, moles working for this sort of company. There's this sort of hired mercenary who's kind of like the you know, the bad human, the kind of action baddie, if you will, in that.
Is that the role Statham would have played like five 6 years ago?
Yeah. in a parallel universe.
Heroically.
And even Statham, when you treat it as a B movie, I think he just works in these films, you know. You don't quite know what accent he's doing. It sort of veers between is he attempting American, or is it just his normal accent? I was never entirely sure, but you know, he just plays it in the classic Statham style. So yeah, on the whole, I thought it was enjoyable. I definitely had qualms in the sense that obviously I'd say go with low expectations. It's not an absolute top tier blockbuster by any means. Treat it as a B movie. And I actually, my biggest qualm of all was I thought that the visual effects were on the weaker side. Like it felt like they didn't have quite as much either time or money as they needed to get it really polished. And there were definitely some moments where I thought like it either felt like real green screen background, or some of the creature action just felt a bit too pixelated and a bit too lightweight, you know, when you just doesn't really have any heft to it.
No.
So that was a disappointment. And I feel like it could have improved if you'd got a bit more time and money on the effects, really. But if you go to the cinema for some B movie action, I felt like it delivered. And another thing I quite enjoyed about it is you get different flavors of action throughout it. So you get right at the beginning, you get this little prologue that's pretty much the whole thing is in the trailer, if you've seen that. But you get this little prologue set in the Cretaceous period where you sort of get a glimpse of some of these little dinosaurs that will return later. Plus you see a T-Rex and you see them a Meg in action there. And then when they go down to the trench, you get this kind of, you know, you get some claustrophobic action there, and you get some like, oh, we've got to put on these suits and do a walk across this, you know, dangerous terrain type action. And it goes this place at the end called Fun Island, which is just this
Fun Island.
Sort of luxury. I think it was filmed in Thailand, but it's this really luxury beach resort where there's a lot of kind of, I suppose, Instagram type people there. And I kind of haven't even said this, but you get three Megs in this film.
Three Megs,
a giant squid type thing, and some other little creatures. There's lots of different things going on like that. That in a way, it felt like a throwback sort of almost to like a 90s kind of monster blockbuster in that way.
That's the vibe I'm getting.
Yeah.
Like a Deep Rising.
Rising, or even I was thinking, I know this is a bad thing to say, but the Godzilla from 98 always puts mine, just because of the fact in there you got those baby Godzillas, didn't you?
Yeah.
It sort of felt like that, where it was sort of throwing everything at it. So yeah, so it felt like a throwback in that way. But like I say, I appreciated you got those different bits of action. It gets kind of straight into the action, really. There's no slow Jaws, like, you know, suspense build up of revealing of the monsters. They kind of go straight into it. I could have done with a bit more of this, but there's a couple of shots that do have like a real nice flair to them, where you can kind of get the sense that there was a bit more of an auteur behind it than just a completely sort of hired hand. Like I won't sort of give it away because it's fun, but there's a really nice fun shot at the end that I could have almost done with, like I say, a bit more of that, because a bit more of that character to it. But all in all, yes, a silly, enjoyable film, I felt, that if you're in the mood for something, and again, you go in with those low expectations, I mean, you sort of know what you're expecting when Statham's leading a film, don't you? You know not to expect anything too serious.
Yeah, he has his niche, really.
But yes, but I did find it quite enjoyable.
Feels like it's coming out at the right time as well, this sort of mid-late summer period, when we've had kind of perhaps the more sort of challenging blockbusters, the ones that have got parts of long-running franchises and cliffhangers and have a lot of weight of expectations on them. So it feels like it's been well-timed altogether.
This is another thing. I often give a film a slight pass when it falls into this category. So maybe I've just done that here. I said it had that throwback vibe to feeling like, you know, something from the 90s maybe. But it felt like if I was on my summer holidays in the 90s, I would have 100% gone to see this and very much enjoyed this.
Yeah,
as
be there opening night.
Yeah, as a young lad. Mm. So I always have a slight soft spot when I know my younger self would have just gone to see it with friends in the summer holidays and really enjoyed it.
So it's a 12A, isn't it?
It's a 12A. It's not too grisly. Like there's a few sort of suspenseful moments and things in there, and like a little bit of blood. But yeah, I actually was thinking that while watching it. I was thinking, I feel like it's not too crazy for children, depending, obviously, you know, you know what they'll be able to handle. But I actually think, yeah, it doesn't go too crazy in that sense. And it does that classic thing of there's plenty of characters they just set up that you just know are going to be eaten, like a bit like in from the sort of Jurassic Park school of doing things, where it's the lawyers, etc., you know, that they have plenty of those that they just set up as deserving of being chomped down. And I'd almost say a tricky thing with the Megs as well is that I almost feel they're slightly limited in what you can do with them, because they're so big and you have to be in the water going against them, that there's only a sort of a limited amount of like human Meg interaction you can get away with. So I think in some ways, perhaps that was why it was, they introduced those other kind of creatures into the mix as well. So you get those different styles of action to play with.
They can't really sneak up, can
no,
they?
No, exactly,
like,
yeah.
Like velociraptors. I mean, that was the kind of genius thing, wasn't it, about Jurassic, is that you've got these really stealthy creatures that could get into smaller places.
Yeah, and with those smaller creatures, there's a thing that, I mean, I guess you'd have to say it was a nod to the grass in The Lost World, Jurassic Park, but just obviously, I mean, it's nowhere near as good as that scene. It looks quite a bit cheaper. But, you know, all that said, I actually found it a throwaway, enjoyable sort of, you know, trashy B movie.
Does it leave it open for another one? The hints?
I mean, you could follow up, but there aren't massive hints. I stayed through the end, and there isn't any end credit scene, in case you're wondering. It's got quite a nice style of credits. Like, it's got this kind of slightly grungy look that made me think, oh, I don't know why, it just made it feel like a Ben Wheatley film, because it's got this almost like this home video look to the, you know, really? You know, when they have, you know, you have the credits and they have, like, you know, images from the film kind of coming up, but it's just more sort of grainy and sort of, you know, rough treatment to it. And that suddenly at the end, I was like, oh yeah, they're sort of giving it a bit of a Ben Wheatley flavor there to remind you that he did.
That's a
it
nice touch.
But yeah, so I'll be really interested to see how well it does at the box office, because Fuzik hasn't been hugely promoted, especially in comparison to some of the other summer films. So it would just be interesting to see if it picks up a lot of you know, people just in the mood for it. Just, I mean, obviously it just screams like summer blockbuster, doesn't it? Just giant monster movie. It's clearly very much like targeting the Chinese market as well, with like Wu Jing's character and Jonas's stepdaughter as well. And Wu Jing's character sort of is kind of like, Statham is still the lead, but he's kind of right up there kind of getting involved as well. So they're clearly eyeing that market as well.
Yeah.
So it'd be interesting to see how it actually does, and if they end up doing another. But obviously, it's left open enough for another. I'm sure there's plenty more stuff that could swim out of the trench.
There's plenty more fish in the sea.
if needed. But yeah, time will tell on that, and I suppose it'll already depend how well this does.
We'll surely have a strong afterlife on home end.
Mm,
don't make the effort to see it at the cinema, it'll surely fly, and it probably won't be too long before it's on digital rental.
Cool. So that is Meg 2, The Trench, which, if you fancy seeing it, that's out in cinemas now. And as it's nearly the end of the episode, there's just enough time for me to ask you to please consider subscribing to the podcast and rating it on your app of choice, which would be enormously helpful to us. And it also means you'll never miss an episode when it drops each week. And as a reminder, you can still pick up the latest issue of Total Film Magazine, which features Gareth Edwards, the creator, on the cover. That's still in shops now, or you can order it online or get it on your device. So before we go, we've just got time for the question of the week, which this time is going to be in honor of Meg 2. What is your favorite movie monster?
My evil monster, or kind of any monster?
I'd say any monster, as long as it's kaiju-sized, I'll say, on account kaiju-sized. Of Meg being so massive.
I think I just have to go with Godzilla, really. Mm. Just because no matter how much destruction and carnage and misery he causes, he's still a hero somehow. You always kind of look at him and think, well, compared to all the others, somehow he's just like, there's something heroic about his atomic breath. And he always comes through in the end, doesn't he? He always fights off. He's always the lesser of two evils. And the movies are quite good at making him an underdog as well. And then they would kind of wheel out something with more heads or that's got armor plating. So, he's such an enduring character. There's always something cool about a Godzilla film.
Godzilla's hard to beat now you've gone for that, really. Mm. But obviously, a special shout out to his old pal, King Kong. I have very, very fond memories of Peter Jackson's 2005 film, which I just absolutely loved at the time.
Fabulous, isn't it?
And I was sort of moved by it and swept up in the spirit of adventure, and I followed along with all those video diaries that PJ was making at the time and putting online in a sort of quite a groundbreaking way. But I almost fear revisiting it just in case it doesn't live up to what I remember, because I know it doesn't really have the greatest reputation now, does it?
And no,
it
strangely,
didn't seem to quite stand the test of time, so I feel very nervous about revisiting that. But I will do one day, and just hope it lives up. I mean, I know particularly people say that the Brontosaurus stampede, where they all start falling off the cliff, perhaps the VFX haven't aged so well in that sequence.
But I don't think that was that great at the time, to be honest. But everything else, I mean, the expressiveness of Kong and the battle with the T-Rex, I mean, that was all fabulous. And I think it's one of the best remakes, really, to be honest.
I just love that you get all these different sections to it as well, that like you've got the mystery and the build up of them setting off on the voyage, and you know, you got that sort of depression era in New York as well, and then you got the kind of like Jurassic Park in the jungle element, and then you got the Kong back in New York and it all being really upsetting at the end. So I've just got very fond memories of it, and I still got the DVDs of the production diaries, and
they were great, weren't they?
Yeah, I've still got the extended version, because Peter Jackson did the Lord of the Rings style extended edition of King Kong as well. I've still got that on the 3-disc set, but haven't revisited it since, you know, best part of 20 years ago when it came out. Yeah, but a special shout out to King Kong there, and I'll give a shout out to the giant goose at the end of Puss in Boots. Without going to spoilers, a recent film which I've seen and enjoyed as well features a kind of kaiju style ending. And that reminded me of Puss in Boots, with the sort of irreverence of that. And I just love that. Yeah, I love that that was the ending to their stealing of the eggs. And there's something, I think we often underestimate how scary it would be if a real animal like a duck or whatever was just massive. There's something more scary about that than it being a complete fantasy dinosaur type creature.
Yeah, you can relate to it.
Shout out to that goose too.
Not geese in movies. Geese.
I mean, there's enough geese, aren't there, with Captain Marvel and Top Gun.
And the wild geese. Yeah, but it's all not actual geese, are they? Yeah, the word goose is certainly prevalent, but real geese.
After all the successful video game adaptations this year, maybe that goose game's gonna be the next one. Come on, I mean, because they're bound to be it. Studios are just gonna be looking, aren't they, for the next massive video game adaptation. I reckon it could be that.
I think so. I think when Hollywood hears this podcast, they'll be greenlighting it.
So that's all we have time for now. But next week, Jane will return with a guest to talk about that week's new releases, which include Gran Turismo, Disney's Haunted Mansion, and Limencita. So, come back next week for that. Just time for us to say goodbye now, then. Bye.
Bye.